How can I tell that the past isn't a fiction designed to account for the discrepancy between my immediate physical sensations and my state of mind? Douglas Adams. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I hope you've had a good weekend. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. Thank you. And if you're a newcomer, welcome to you too. And I hope you will avail yourself of our backlog of episodes. Please like, rate, subscribe, download, etc. if you have the time. So, this week we're leaving Cyprus and returning to the mainland. From there, we're going to talk about kind of the final stretch of coast along the northern Levant, where this meets the Anatolian Peninsula, and afterwards we're going to move east into Mesopotamia proper, the part actually between the two rivers. But that being said, we probably will be focusing on the northern Levant, south-central Anatolia, for at least two episodes. I think this one and the next one, maybe a third, we'll just have to wait and see. I was going to try and get a lot done, but I've had a lot of technical issues, and it is getting late for my time, so I'm going to record as much as I can, and then we'll see where we are, and might have to cut this episode a little short, but I want to get it at least as long as last week's. But before we dive into the peoples, I did want to talk about the kind of geography for the northern Levant, central Levant, and I've kind of gone over this a little bit, but I had a couple of requests to go into a little more detail on what I've talked about in the other Levantine episodes this season and prior seasons, and I'm going to kind of add a little more information and kind of connect some threads we've had hanging around. So this episode is probably going to be more geography focused, and then from there we'll talk about people and kind of what's going on. Now, I mentioned briefly the Lebanon and anti-Lebanon mountain ranges in the Central Levant episode. The Lebanon range runs parallel to the Mediterranean Sea. And it actually is very parallel to the sea. And it is about 170 kilometers long, which is 110 miles, and averages about 2,500 meters in elevation, which is like 8,200, I think, feet, excuse me. And its peak is at 3,088 meters, which is 10,130-some-odd feet. The name is theorized to have come from the Semitic word for white, which would be like an LBN. We obviously don't know what the vowels for that would have been. That's one of the mysteries of the Semitic languages, the vowels, especially when you're writing it out. But it's probably referring to the snows that cover the mountains, similar to the theory that the origin of the Caucasus range, Caucasus being like shining or bright. Also, you know, the white snows on the Caucasus give its name to the Caucasus. Of course, these are different language families, so they sound very different, but that's the main theory that I've read. I haven't seen anything else really go into detail. And then you have the Bekaa Valley, which I've already gone into detail on why that's important. I did that in the Central Levant episode. And as for the name, I believe for that, it is just related to the Arabic word for bottom or bed. So it's literally the bottom valley. Now, then you have the anti-Lebanon range. This comes from the Greek and Latin antilibanus, meaning opposite, in this case anti, and parallel to the Lebanon range, which they called Lebanos. In Arabic, they're called Jabal Luban Ash-Sharqiya, and I do apologize to my Arabic listeners, I know I butchered that, or just the Eastern Lebanon Mountains. Now, this range is also home to cedar trees, though apparently not as much as the Lebanon Mountains. But they had and still do have other types of trees and bushes like apricots, firs, cherry trees, pistachios, and others. Though overgrazing is hurting the area's ecology in some places. And that's probably something that different parts of the mountains have had to deal with at different times. I'm sure it's gotten to a point where certain parts of the valleys are abandoned, allow time for regrowth to happen, and then people will move back in. That's something that's been going on for basically since this time frame forward. Now, these mountains are also a great source for chalk, limestone, and travertine. And that's a type of limestone that is more porous, and it ranges in color a little bit more. It can go from white to tan to cream to kind of a rusty red. And that was used as decoration in a lot of places in the Near East, especially in a lot of early temples and public buildings, once they start to really go wild with the decorations and things like that. Now, the Anti-Lebanon Mountains also serve as a rain shadow for the land to their east. They're the reason that the Syrian desert exists. The Assyrians and Babylonians call these mountains the Cedar Mountains. Now, I haven't been able to find out what the Akkadians and Sumerians called the region, but they may not have even had a name for it, instead referring to the people or settlements in the region when they talk about this place, like it would be the land of such and such or so and so. That also reminds me, I'll probably talk about this again later, but the various kingdoms of Mesopotamia usually referred to the Mediterranean Sea as the Upper Sea, or in the Akkadian, Tamtu Ilutu or Tamtu Elinitu. Depending on how formal they were trying to be. Elitu and Elinitu both can mean sea, but one's a little bit more formal. And this is in contrast with the Persian Gulf, or as they called it, the Lower Sea, or Supaliti Elitu, or Supaliti Elintiu, or Elinitu, excuse me. And they'll add other names or descriptions, depending on how poetic they're trying to be, or the time frame that the mention is made. And sometimes the names shift a little over time. But those are the translations that are most common. Upper Sea, Lower Sea. Now, another geographic feature that we need to talk about is the coastal mountain range, or the Sisalat al-Jabal Ash-Sahiliya, which, again, apologies to my Arabic listeners. They're also called the Jabal al-Ansariya, or the Jabal al-Nusayriya, or the Jabal al-Alawiyyin. Forgive me. But that is literally the coastal mountain range. And this is the kind of mountain range that is in the modern country of Syria. It separates most of Syria from their coast. Those mountains kind of divide the country from their coastal plain and then the rest of the modern country of Syria. Now, the mountains have an average width of 32 kilometers, which is 20 miles, and their average elevation is just over 1,200 meters, which is around 3,900 feet. And its highest point is Nabi Yunis, and this reaches 15,062 meters, which is around 5,120 some odd feet. And then you have at the south, it's the average is much lower, like the part where it's close to the Lebanon Mountains. It averages around 600 meters, which is around 2,000 feet. And then in the north, if you go further, closer to where this coastal plain connects to Anatolia, it gets a little higher there than in the south, but it doesn't pass 900 meters, which is around 3,000 feet. So at the extreme south and the extreme north of this little range, you essentially have two parts where you can enter or exit the coastal plain, and that's something that you'll see continually throughout history. Going through the mountains is possible, but it's just not done very often because there aren't too many good routes, at least for large numbers of people. But, you know, it can be done. It's just not as common as just going around the mountains, at least when you talk about things like armies and large-scale migrations or things like that. Now, in the south, where kind of that little slight decrease in elevation from the Lebanon going into the coastal mountains of Syria, you do have the Orontes River, which is the primary river source for most of the early history of the period. Now, that river has been dammed up to an extent. This created the Katana River in modern Syria. So the area is much different today than it was in the past. It was a fertile plain. It still is. In fact, part of the reason that the dam was created was to increase the fertility of the area. Parts of this depression are known as, well, the depression itself is known as the Algab Plain or the Algab Depression. And this literally means forest plain. But the soil there was not always the best. It was very hit or miss. There were some areas that were extremely fertile, and there were some areas that were not. And part of that is because of the Orontes River and other rivers, like I think it's the Al-Kahir River. The area was actually very marshy for a lot of human history. So not the best place with the constant water and flooding and things like that for large-scale agriculture. But it was a very good place to set up fisheries and things like that. I think there was catfish was a very big part of diet and economy for people living in the area for a long time. I think even into the modern day. I think until the 50s, essentially, when they started the project. 50s or 60s when they finished it up. Crops were growable, but the soil, this is not like Al-Bekaa, the Al-Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. This area had a lot more, diversity in terms of what it produced, but it also had more adversity as well. So just keep that in mind, too, when thinking about this region. Now, there are not very many cities, at least large cities, located along the coastal plain to the west of the mountains. And that's true today. And from what I can tell, it was true historically, too. That's not to say there are no settlements. There certainly were. But they never really quite gained, at least as far as I can see, kind of the prominence that you would see further south in the Phoenician cities and in the Canaan cities along the coast to the south. I'm not 100% sure why this is. I'm going to make an educated guess based on what I've read. Now, I could be very wrong, and I'm going to continue to research this, but from what I can tell, the coast alternates between having, like, a lot of very sandy soil and large sand dunes, and then having very rocky kind of soil. So that's part of the reason. Another reason is it doesn't look like the harbors where you would be able to safely dock ships are very deep. Now, that's probably not too much of a problem at early stages of, you know, human sailing and all that, because the ships don't necessarily need very deep water. But, you know, for things like protecting against storms and things like that, that is still necessary. So the harbors there may not have been the best for docking ships. Also, I know cities to the south, the Phoenician cities especially, were very aggressive in maintaining their preeminence with things like trade and sea travel. And I'm willing to bet they did not always like each other. I very much doubt that they would have liked people to their north, especially that close to the north, having being rivals either. And they were more closely related to their neighbors. But generally speaking, while they may have fought with each other, they would equally, in times of need, band together to defend themselves and each other from outsiders. And that would include peoples not even that far north of them. I'm also not sure that the mountains would necessarily provide as much wood as the ones further south did. I don't see very many, or I haven't seen very many historical mentions of the area being known for a lot of large-scale tree growth and wood, you know, useful for making ships. So it's possible they may just not have had the resources to build large fleets. Also, a lot of the important, quote-unquote important cities in this region are on the western side of the mountains. And they may have kind of kept a check over the coastal settlements. By kind of closing off trade to the Mesopotamian states to the east and south, they definitely controlled all the overland routes through their territory. As I mentioned, places to the south, the Phoenician cities, if they wanted to, could cut off sea access or hampered sea access to any kind of coastal settlements. They also can just go through that Gob Depression or the Gob Valley and take in, say, if the coastal settlements along Syria's mountain coast, if the inland settlements wanted to bypass them, they easily could. There are ways into Canaan, into Lebanon, into Phoenicia, where they don't have to worry about going down that coastal road. They controlled the access points through the mountains. So any kind of coastal settlements were probably very dependent on larger, better positioned, more populous cities. That's my guess anyway, from what I can tell from sources and reading and just general history of the region. In fact, past that, Al-Gab, there is what's known as the Alms Gap or Akar Gap. Sometimes it's called Al-Bukaya. It's a relatively flat passage in the Orontes River Valley, and it is called the gateway to Syria. So it's what separates the Syrian coastal mountain range from the Lebanon and anti-Lebanon mountains. So that was a huge point of entry and exit to Syria or to Phoenicia, Canaan, whichever way you were going, that's a good way to get through. And it's extremely important even today. They've built highways and railroads through there. There's even, I think, an oil pipeline that goes through the gap. The Crusaders will eventually build the famous Croc de Chevalier Castle. They built it in the Homs Gap. It's a very, very important strategic region. In fact, Homs itself, which I had a viewer ask a question about, probably grew up from an early fortificated site. Fortified site. There were probably a number of small villages, towns in and around the modern city of Homs, and you know, they would each rise and fall as, you know, things changed, but eventually the fortifications around Homs helped give rise to a larger city, and eventually it's the primary seat of the government in that area, the city of Homs. And I had a viewer ask how old it was, and it's very old. I think it goes back to at least the 2000 BC, though it was never as large as some of the other important Syrian cities. And it's not as old as those cities either. Though, again, probably, you know, a number of villages kind of rose up and fell apart as time goes on in the region. Unfortunately, because of the work on the Orontes River Dam and all this other stuff, we've probably, like the Syrian Civil War, like that's a minor thing. There's probably a lot of archaeology that we've missed out on. Hopefully, one day, we can learn more about early inhabitation of the area. And I can't remember if I've mentioned it, so I'm just going to say it again. In the classical period, this mountain range was known as the Bargalis. That's the Greek term for the mountain ranges, and that came to the Romans. And that name will actually be used for, it came from a city-state or kingdom, I don't know if it was a specific group of people who took their name from the city, or if they gave their name to the city. I don't know, but I believe it's the Bara. That's well in the future, but I just wanted to mention that that was the historical name, or the classical period name, for the mountain range before the Arabs spread to the region. Now, the next geographical feature is a little bit further north, and it is another mountain range. These are the Nur Mountains, or in the Turkic, Nur Dağları, or the Mountains of Holy Light, also known as the Alma Dağ. The ancient Greeks called it the Amanos, and I think in the medieval period they were just called the Black Mountains, or in Arabic, the Jabal al-Lukam. Now, these are the mountains are just to the south of the Taurus Mountains and the Ceyhan River, and they kind of run to that gulf of its Iskenderun, formerly the Gulf of Alexandria, I believe. Now, these range, it's about 100 miles in length, and the maximum elevation is about 2,240 meters. So that's 200 kilometers and about 7,350 feet. And this divides what in the classical period is known as Cilicia from inland Syria. And it's kind of one of the natural borders between Asia Minor or Anatolia and the rest of the Middle East or Southwest Asia. And there's a major pass that goes through these mountains. This is known as the Belen Pass, or the Syrian Gates. Also, you'll sometimes see it called the Amanic Gates, or the Bakshe Pass, I believe is the Turkish. I probably butchered that pronunciation. I do apologize for all my mispronunciations on this episode, which I'm sure there are many. These mountains are they form like a little shield around the area of Cilicia, which we're going to talk about specifically. It's going to be part of this section. But this is another one of those regions where you have that barrier where the Syrian cities and kingdoms can kind of form a chokehold over the region. Though, Because of the way the Near Mountains are formed, occasionally you'll have people from Anatolia controlling the pass. Now, that lets them go down the coast, but it's not necessarily, even if they control the coastal route, they don't necessarily get into Syria all the time. This is something, as I'm sure you can guess, that is back and forth for numerous states and kingdoms. So I hope you're looking forward to that. I know, I certainly am. Now, once you cross the Nur Mountains to the west, you get to the region known as Cilicia. And this comes from a very old... it comes from the Greek, who gave it to the Latins, or to the Romans, and we got it from the Romans. The Greeks' spelling was derived from the Hilaku, but this is a term used by by one of the Assyrian empires to kind of designate kind of the western portion of their territories, far western portion of their territories, though I don't know what it is supposed to mean. Now, Cilicia, you can divide in kind of two separate regions. At least that's how the Greeks did. There was Rough Cilicia, and then there was Plain Cilicia. Now, Rough Cilicia, as you might guess, was named for the mountains that kind of jutted down from the Taurus to the north. And this is kind of the boundary of the Anatolian Peninsula we're going to be talking about. That's what divides this part of Anatolia from the other parts of Anatolia that we're going to discuss. So we're not going north of the Taurus Mountains or further to the west. Now, Plain Cilicia is important because it is where you will see all of the major agricultural sites in southern Anatolia. And they are very important for providing a lot of food to the region. It was a very important and desired area for a number of kingdoms that will rise up, specifically the Assyrians, first of all, and then there are more that will come along later. I think the Assyrians were first. It may have been the Hittites, but regardless, this is... one of the first big population centers where you'll see a lot of permanent settlements pop up in Anatolia after the abandonment of the Tas Tepler sites and Çatalhöyük, which, again, they were not too far off from these places. There are a couple of rivers that run through here. I already mentioned the Shehan, or the Kehan. I'm not sure the correct pronunciation. But there's also the Burden, the Göksu, and the Sihan. Now, the one I refer to, the Çehan, I believe, is historically, or at least in the Greek language, known as the Pyramos, or the Pyramus. And I think the earlier versions of the Greek also called it the Leucocerus, or I believe in Arabic it's just the Jehun. I think that's Arabic. I'm not sure. But this river comes down from the Taurus Mountains. It's one of the things that makes Cilicia fertile and able to support a lot of crops and things like that. So that's kind of the geographic outline of what we're going to be looking at in northern Anatolia, northern Levant, southern South Central Anatolia. Next week, I'm going to jump in and cover early settlements at this site and who the peoples living in them may have been, or at least some of them. There are probably a number of different peoples from several linguistic groups, several ethnic groups. And then after that, we're going to cover some of the more inland Syria around the Euphrates River. And then from there, we'll talk about those people probably all in one episode. So we'll go over the Euphrates area of Syria, the peoples living there, and that will finish up the Northern Levant. Then we'll move to Mesopotamia proper. I'm actually finishing up a couple of books on the Sumerians and other early peoples in the region and the Ubaid period. So I hope you're looking forward to that. It's actually been very eye-opening. I learned some things I had never heard before. Things that are just kind of not mentioned and glossed over, at least in most popular sources and even in some academic circles. I was surprised at what I was learning. So I hope you're all looking forward to the next time. We're going to be talking about a number of early settlements at this period and peoples. I'm going to go ahead and mention that this is an area where you see actually two different branches of the Semitic languages. The Eastern and Western kind of meet up in this region. At least on the western side of the mountain, probably more of the Semitic people we've been talking about most often, the western branch. But on the other side of the mountains, you'll have the Eastern Semitic peoples. Among them, probably the Proto-Akkadians, though I don't know if that would even be close to what they are at this period. That's something that we'll have to dive into and see. I hope you'll you're interested, and I hope you'll continue to join me. I do appreciate all the support. I know this was a very geography-heavy episode. I know that's not necessarily what a lot of people are into. I do recommend you follow me on Twitter. I do post pictures and stuff. I posted some reconstructions of the Kirikitian houses on Cyprus, as well as some photos of the pot shards that they've discovered from the Sotira culture on Cyprus. And I'm going to try to do a better job about posting pictures and stuff during the week, not just on the episode links, because I generally post like on Wednesday and that's it. But I want to do a little bit more. I want to kind of keep the channel growing, the show growing. So if you guys have any questions or feedback, please let me know. You can email me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter. You can leave a comment on my YouTube videos. I will eventually see them. I may not see them immediately, but I do try to respond fairly quickly. I do live stream on YouTube most of the week and sometimes on the weekends. So if you subscribe to the channel there, you see me go live, you're welcome to drop in the chat, talk there, ask questions, or just watch in silence. That's A-okay too. I have plenty of people who do that. So thank you all for joining me this week. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. I'm glad this was a little bit longer than last week's. I thought I'd be able to stretch last week's a little bit longer, but I kind of hit the high points and got through what I needed. But yeah, thank you all. Please like, subscribe, download, hit any kind of notification stuff. It really helps me out, keeps the channel growing. I'm hoping to hit 6,000 downloads before the end of November, maybe even push it to 7, we'll see. But yeah, thank you all so much for joining me. I hope you've liked this episode, and I hope you will be back next time. Thank you all. Have a good day. Have a good night. Have a great week. Until I see you next time. Peace.